but you have to you know, eliminate stuff close to the house. Intense fire fronts as close as 30 feet away will not start a wooden wall into flames if you have the right stuff. So here's my concluding remarks. We have to reduce greenhouse gas emissions at some point, because that is exacerbating the fire spread. And climate and weather drives large fires. Fuel reductions have limited value under extreme fire weather. Worse, they are expensive and delusional. The probability that any large blaze will encounter fuel treatment is very low, at least during the time when it might work. Wildfires and natural events like bark beetles improve and invigorate ecosystems, and large wildfires and beetles provide the bulk of dead tree recruitment in the forest ecosystem, which, as I tried to prove or show, is really important for a lot of species. And finally, we should be spending a lot more money trying to reduce home flammability and zoning to prevent building in the fire plane. And I'm not totally against thinning, you know, a couple of hundred feet maybe away from the edge of a town, do prescribed burns there every year or two. That could really maybe help in a major fire. But we're not doing that. We're doing it in the wrong places. And even though a fire may never encounter those, at least if you did it every year, like a prescribed burn right next to town, you would know that if that happened to be the bad year for you, that you had done everything you could. So I always like this last picture. I have a story to tell with it. It's my kids. When I was doing the wildfire book, they traveled around with me, and we were going to all these wildfires around the West and burning fires. And when my daughter got back to her town after a summer traveling around with me looking at fires, she was talking to a couple of girlfriends, you know, and one girlfriend says, "Oh yeah, I went to my grandmother's place on the ocean, and we spent, you know, 2 weeks there going in the ocean. It was so much fun." And another friend said, "Yeah, I went to camp and I learned to canoe and so forth. So what did you do, Summer?" And she said, "Well, I traveled around the West with my dad looking at wildfires and burnt trees." So that's the end of my talk. Thanks for listening.
That's it for this episode of Coast Range Radio. Huge thanks to Silas, Karen, and Jennifer with the Stop Clearcutting California team from the Sierra Club for putting on the Forest Protection Forum series, which is where this talk was recorded. You can find all of their webinars, including a great one from our very own Chuck Willer, by searching Stop Clearcutting CA, or find links to that and more in the show notes of the podcast feed. Okay, thanks for listening. My email is michael@coastrange.org, and we will be back soon with some great new episodes.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Listener-supported community radio.
Andy Wall-O looks a scream, and him on my woe. Andy Wall-O, silver stream, can't tell them apart at all.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guests this week are Mary Weaver Chapin, the curator of prints and drawings at the Portland Art Museum, and Ian Gillingham, the head of press and marketing. They're here talking about psychedelic rock posters and fashion of the 1960s, which is on now at the museum through June 15th. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus.
It's great to be here, Joseph. Thanks for coming to the museum. We have quite a visual treat for you.
We're so looking forward to walking through the galleries with you today, Joseph.
Mary, in the 60s, especially in San Francisco, when rock bands, particularly psychedelic rock bands, advertised their shows, there was a whole kind of graphic style that grew up in the posters. And you've collected how many pieces?
Visitors will see almost 200 posters and handbills in the exhibition, almost all from the San Francisco scene around 1965 to 70, and we have one gallery devoted to psychedelic Portland, too.
So as you come in, there's a Jefferson Airplane ad, basically. It's a black poster with green lettering. It says Jefferson Airplane and the Quicksilver Messenger Service, Saturday only. Lightning Hopkins at the Fillmore Auditorium. So this is it says a dance concert presented by Bill Graham. The graphics, I would call this like bubble writing. That's what we used to practice as little kids in our school books. It's a sort of warped green, puffy lettering, and then it changes to white for the name of a different band. Was this kind of font style already around before this kind of rock movement?
Well, you've picked one of the earliest posters in our show, and it's significant that you could read everything, Joseph. You read it right off the poster. This early style was highly legible, and just as you said, they look like kind of inflated bubble letters. But what the artist, in this case Wes Wilson, is doing is he's making them like curve around a shape and take on a life of their own. And so we see him starting with this style, but soon getting even more inventive and playful. And as you progress down this wall in the exhibition, you get to the point where his lettering is almost entirely indecipherable. Mm-hmm. And that's where you really see his genius come through.
So this shape he's formed, I mean, it's sort of several kind of globes stuck together, and, you know, maybe it looks like a poodle, you know, with puffed out round legs. Is it an abstract shape?
Yes, if it's, I see it as an abstract sculptural shape, but it's funny when you said that, almost like a poodle. It could be a balloon animal. Do you get that sense mm-hmm. too? Mm-hmm. And as we move down the wall, you see him turning the lettering into a sculptural feature. So we call this gallery Text as Image and Image as Text.
Actually, the one next to it is Andy Warhol and his Plastic Inevitable and the Velvet Underground, Nico and the Mothers, 1966. So when he got to work with he's making a piece about an artist. Mm-hmm. Did his style change particularly, or was that a big deal to have Andy Warhol showing up in San Francisco?
People naturally assume that it was the bands or the artists choosing who would make their posters, but there was no contact at all. It was the promoters. Mm-hmm. So I think I can't speak for Wes Wilson, but I think for him it was, you know, just another poster. Artwork due on Monday, poster goes up on Thursday, you better be ready. I mean, these guys were working in a really short turnaround. And one thing that's interesting, today we're so conscious of brand, of promoting, of signature images and fonts. Visitors coming through will notice that bands are treated differently in every poster. Sometimes their names aren't even spelled correctly, but it was really up to the designer to make an engaging visual image.
But this is still Wes Wilson. This is using orange, mostly orange lettering, some white for Andy Warhol, and it's all on a black background. Bill Graham is very prominent. So these artists were just freelancers, and someone at the Fillmore would call them up and say, this is what we got?
Exactly. There were two main venues, the Fillmore Auditorium, and that was run by Bill Graham, and the Avalon Ballroom, and that was headed by a man named Chet Helms. And as we walk down, if I can lure you down the way a little bit, you'll notice that Bill Graham always liked his name to be very legible. But Wes Wilson's, the artist, started playing with the text, and now in this example, another Buffalo Springfield example, in yellow and black, you see how the artist is actually looking back to a historical precedent. He's looking at the work of Alfred Roller, who was an Austrian poster designer right around 1905. He was working. And you can see that he makes his letters by carving out the negative space. So you almost start with a rectangle and leave the what's remaining. But unlike Roller, who kept everything in a very straight format, here Wes Wilson is starting to curve the letters, and so they start forming the shape of this wonderful, I don't even know what it is, it's sort of like a headdress coming off the man's head. Mm-hmm. And then apparently there was a pretty strong argument between the artist Wes Wilson and promoter Bill Graham. And apparently Graham said to Wilson, these are terrible, no one can read the posters. Mm-hmm. And Wilson replied, yeah, that's the point, man, because they were really looking to appeal to a subculture, someone who would be willing to stand there and read the poster or decipher it as long as it took. And one of his masterpieces is this red and green poster for the association, where the letters have become flame-like and they seem to wiggle and burst towards the top of the poster. And really the only highly legible thing is presented in San Francisco by Bill Graham.
Where is that? Oh, that's in black at the top. Yeah. The setup is a kind of grass green background with bright red lettering. Each letter is sort of twisted like a flame, but he's given a little white shadow. You know, the right side of each letter has a kind of white line, which is where a shadow would be if it was three-dimensional. But it's just incredibly hard to read because the green on red just like hurts your eyes.
Absolutely. And they were playing with this contrast of colors, of complementary colors. And so when they're at the same intensity, our eye doesn't know if we're focusing on foreground or background. And so you kind of flicker back and forth until you understand which part of it you're trying to read. And that's a common theme throughout the museum. There are some that are very, very difficult to make out.
Mm-hmm. This is Ian.
Mary has referred to these posters as the best worst advertisement ever, and certainly I see that from my own role in public relations and marketing. We want to get the message out, we want to get people through the doors, and that may well have been the purpose, but it was also really an in-group signifier. It was really part of the difficulty of legibility, really helped let people know that if you were in the know, man, you'd know where to go.
Mm-hmm. Tell us, what are the basics of a good poster, you know, in terms of what you learn in graphic design school, right? You've got to have certain words big and certain words in certain places, date and time.
It comes down to the who, what, where, when, and why. And people need to be able to grasp it in a fast-moving environment. Maybe they're seeing it on a bus as you're moving by. They're walking down the street. And I like to joke that these artists obscured the who, what, where, and when, but they focused on the why, because they promise you some sort of groovy experience. You can't quite make out who's going to be there, but they suggest that there's something happening that is maybe out of the ordinary, maybe psychedelic, and definitely groovy. So these failed the basic design test, and by breaking these rules, it really made them look something new and attract attention.
Mm-hmm. There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear.
And then what? One more Victor Masosko piece is more conventional. It's a photo of a band with their gear walking towards the viewer. In the background is a kind of a fireworks display of kind of tie-dye colors, yellow and green and orange and black. It's a Chicago Fire Steve Miller Blues Band poster. But the writing around the edge is kind of like an optical illusion. The border is pink and the blue marks look like hieroglyphics. They're kind of royal blue. And it's only when you change your vision and you see the blue marks are the gaps between the letters that you can read it. It's just quite hard to read. July, I've lost it again.
Yes, you know, there is this this struggle to move in and out of the image to make out what is foreground and what is background. And this poster was is a loan that came in 2023, and I've been working with it since then, and it's only recently that my eyes clicked in and I can read it, and I have to stand a certain distance. But this is by Victor Moscoso, who was very, very skilled with color and loved kind of playing these games with the viewer. He also discovered that it was faster for him to work by drawing the negative space rather than drawing the outlines of the letter. So basically what we're seeing in all the lettering is just negative space, and then our eye makes up the rest with the pink.
So this is a lithograph. What was his original material?
They would usually start with pen and ink or graphite. And then they would have to get the artwork to the printers, and then the printers would help with color separations, and then boom, they would get them out on the street, and the next week there would be a new poster. Mm-hmm. So it happened very fast.
So he wouldn't be painting in blue ink on pink. he would leave the coloring work to the printer?
Well, yes and no. So his designs would be in black and white, and he would make color notes, but these artists almost always were present there with the printer and demanding to get the sort of color saturation and intensities that they were looking for. Moscoso's an interesting case because although many of these artists were untrained, he was very highly trained, and especially in the science of color. He had an MFA from Yale University and had trained with Joseph Albers, one of the leading color theorists of the 20th century.
So he knew how to, like, mess with your eyes.
That's exactly right. And he likes to say everything he learned at Yale, he turned upside down.
The way that this fits into the art history really is that it connects with the op art movement, the way that op art movement was an extension of chromoluminarism. Do I have that right? The divisionism of the early 20th century, where you get these, that in the same way that as the pointillists were playing with the way that the colors would resolve in your eyes, they were doing something that was really deeply based in the art history of the time.
Absolutely right, not only in the art history, but in the optical sciences, and furthermore on how color makes us feel, how we perceive it, how colors react when they're placed next to each other. So it's been a long game with artists to see what they can draw from color.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guests this week are Mary Weaver Chapin, the curator of prints and drawings, and Ian Gillingham, the head of press and marketing at the Portland Art Museum. They're talking about psychedelic rock posters and fashion of the 1960s, a show on now at the Portland Art Museum through June 15th. Mary, you also have fashion on display here. There are a series of mannequins in sort of, pop 60s mini dresses, but also some kind of crushed velvet menswear, kind of sort of Victorian looking frock coats and long lacy dresses. Who provided these clothes, and why are they in here with the posters?
The fashions all come from the collection of Gary Westford, and Gary is a very generous collector and donor. He's made gifts of many posters to the museum, and we wanted to show the interaction between many different styles of poster art at the time and the really eclectic fashions. So there's no one-to-one correspondence, but you'll see like a kaleidoscope shape in a poster and then maybe notice the same sort of motif in a mini dress. Or you might see an Art Nouveau paisleys in some of the clothing and then see those same kind of swirling designs in the poster. So the fashion has been really fun, and people have found it very relatable, talking about either things they wore or things that are still in their parents' closet.
Mm-hmm. Did paisley begin that long ago?
Paisley's even older, and it was sort of a revival. So you get lots of wonderful arabesque shapes and curving shapes. And again, it's hard to categorize this group of fashions because it was so eclectic. It could be Edwardian or cowboy inspired, but I think everyone will recognize the bright mini dresses as pure 60s pop.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're standing in front of a poster by Wes Wilson advertising the Ballylow Boutique. And this was a fashion store right in downtown in Union Square, San Francisco. And not only was it a fashion boutique, but it was also a ticket outlet. So you could go buy your tickets to the Avalon or the Fillmore there and shop for fashions. And what's really fun about this poster, in addition to its gorgeous design, is that the donor, Gary Westford, worked at Ballylow for a few years when he was in San Francisco and picking up, absorbing all these great influences. And you might notice there's a strong Art Nouveau influence to the poster. And in this section, you'll see how inspired the 1960s artists were by Art Nouveau, which was an international movement in the 1890s in Europe and the United States. And so we brought in two outside artists. Here you'll see two posters by Alphonse Mucha, who was the leading figure of Art Nouveau in France in the 1890s. And you can see how the artists copied the designs, mm-hmm. but put them to new usage.
So you've done a compare and contrast. These are original prints
mm-hmm, yes.
of Mucha. And what are they advertising? It's a woman with flowing brown hair. She's in a profile with her head tossed back. And then there's letters behind her, Job, I think.
Yes, it's not immediately identifiable for modern audiences, but she is advertising Job cigarette papers. And you can see, you know, her closed eyes and tilted back head. You can see how much she's enjoying those cigarette papers. The artists Stanley Mouse and Alton Kelly love that image. Of course, it was considered quite risque for a woman to smoke in the 1890s. So they've used that same image. And now she's advertising a concert at the Avalon Ballroom. But she has been transformed by color. And we like to joke, we're not entirely sure what she rolled in her cigarette papers.
I mean, they really just copied it, right? It's a direct copy. It's not hand-drawn. But then he's put... Mouse and Kelly have put Jim Queskin, Jug Band, Big Brother and the Holding Company, Electric Train, you know, words on the top where Job was. Was that okay? Was that all right to just steal an image?
That's a great question. And it's something we think a lot more about today than at the time. These were posters made on a short schedule. They were entirely ephemeral. They'd go up for a week, come down, something else would go up. So I don't think they'd pass any copyright tests today, but it was very much part of their practice. And one of the most famous examples in our exhibition is in the next section and features the Grateful Dead. So I'm glad to have Ian here with me because Ian saves me from my own bad spelling day after day for museum publications. But here we're in front of a poster where they've spelled the name wrong. Can you tell us what happened, Ian?
Oh, yes, it's Grateful with a G-R-E-A-T-F-U-L.
So the Grateful Dead's name is not spelled correctly on the poster, but I think all the concert goers would have found it nonetheless. And it's really interesting. This is a poster from August of 1966. And next to it is another poster for the Grateful Dead that looks entirely different. There wasn't one homogenous branding style. It was entirely up to the artists on how to depict the bands.
Mm-hmm. And the first one is a white background with a mostly yellow and then wavy black writing. The Grateful Dead, the date, the names of the other bands, lights by Bill. Looks like Bill Ham.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's at the Avalon. And then there's Frankenstein's face is in the middle of it. For I don't know why, but then when
no reason really.
When you go next to it, there's this classic red, blue, and light blue Grateful Dead poster with a skeleton, with the roses and its hands and on its head.
And this, I think, is perhaps the most recognizable poster in the entire show. The image, again, the artists are Stanley Mouse and Alton Kelly. They often work together. And they often went to the San Francisco Public Library for inspiration. They'd look through image files. They'd comb through the stacks. And one day they came across this engraving that was in a book of ancient translated poetry. And they immediately saw it and thought, aha, we've got to use that. So they took out a penknife, carefully cut it out of the book, stole it, secreted it out of the San Francisco Public Library. And they recount that they knew immediately that this is one they would use for the Grateful Dead. Now, the original source image is in black and white, so they transformed it again with color. And this particular tone of blue and this particular tone of red really became emblematic for the Grateful Dead. I feel like this is kind of the start of their real branding.
Mm. So before they ever used this as album art or anything, this image was dreamed up just for a poster for a one show, couple of shows.
Yes, that's right. And before that, it was dreamed up by the artist Edward Joseph Sullivan. And so there are so many layers of history in this show. You can come and enjoy it just for this 1960s moment, but there are all sorts of historical references sprinkled throughout. So, Ian, there's another important reason that we're doing our exhibition. What are the Portland Art Museum's ties to the psychedelic scene here in Portland?
Well, so we're here in the Portland Art Museum's Mark Building, which, of course, used to be the Portland Masonic Temple. In that space, many bands of the 1960s came through and played because on the I-5 corridor between San Francisco and Seattle, they would take their buses up the freeway, and many of them would stop in Portland and play. And so, for instance, the Grateful Dead, who we've just been talking about, they played in 1968, I believe, right here in the Grand Ballroom of what is now our museum.
And there is a room full of Portland-related posters here.
The Portland room is really fun. Our friends over at the Oregon Historical Society were very generous lenders. We found artists, local historians who could share their information about what was Portland like back in the day. And it has proven to be one of the most popular galleries. It's in a beautiful electric blue. And in our interview, Joseph, we're only touching on a few things, but there are many galleries all based on various themes. So I hope visitors will kind of explore them in any order they like. It's sort of a choose your own adventure exhibition. Mm-hmm. We have local Portland artists and also San Francisco artists who later landed in Oregon. And among my favorites is Bob Raphael Schneff. He goes by Raph now. He was a young man in San Francisco back in the day. A very highly trained artist, and he got involved making posters for The Family Dog. We're standing in front of my favorite poster by him, which was done for The Doors and Lothar and the Hand People, and it features an image of a woman with outstretched hands surrounded by others who are ringing cymbals and playing the tambourine, and there are blowing horns. It really looks like a good party.
So it's funny, some of these bands I'd never heard of, Lothar and the Hand People. These were just like the warm-up bands of the time?
The exhibition is full of very, very famous bands and bands that are almost completely lost to history. I love giving tours of the show, and the people who really know their music history surprise me. They'll pull out memories of some of these bands that I've never heard of. There was also a really interesting mix. So you might go to a show and hear sort of like electric rock, but also a jug band or blues and psychedelia. So it was just such an eclectic mixture. And that was a real feature of these concerts.
There are, on this last wall next to the Bob Raphael piece, either side, there's one, it has a picture of the Redeemer statue, I think, from Brazil, standing over a kind of flaming orange ocean, and this spiky kind of cuneiform writing. You know, it's the Paul Butterfield Blues Band. So not everything is in this sort of dreamy bubble writing style. Was it just like a free-for-all? I mean, or did this poster...
Yes, it was a free-for-all, and well put. And the artists were looking at each other. So they might see what one of their fellow artists was doing and say, oh, I can do that one better, or what if I went this way? Now, the poster you just described by David Singer, he tended towards more legible script. You're right, it does look like an ancient cuneiform or Middle Eastern script, but he was also beloved by the producer Bill Graham because it's creative, but it's always legible. And that was so important for Bill Graham, who wanted to pack his dance halls and sell tickets. Visitors are also encouraged to use our Bloomberg audio guide. You'll find green symbols throughout the exhibition with a QR code, and you'll hear from artists and curators and historians. And it's just a lot of fun.
And you can listen on your phone?
Exactly right. Listen on your phone. In the Portland galleries, we're also proud to feature psychedelic bench covers by local fashion designer Adam Arnold. Adam just had this visionary idea to create op art cushions to decorate the room, and they are works of art themselves. I can't tell you how many questions I've gotten about them and how beloved they are.
So these are just padded tops, but he's taken a black and white checkerboard and twisted it so it's never regular, but one corner of each one has a kind of yellow submarine, pink, green and mauve swirly horn, like it's been dipped in candy or something. Normally he makes like guys suits and
yes, fashion
dresses,
yeah.
But this is him going a bit wild. My name's Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guests this week were Mary Weaver-Chapin and Ian Gillingham. Mary is the curator of prints and drawings, and Ian is the head of press and marketing. They were talking about psychedelic rock posters and fashion of the 1960s, a show on now at the Portland Art Museum through June 15th. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus again.
Always a pleasure, Joseph.
Such fun, Joseph. Thanks so much.
Andy, whoa, whoa, looks a scream. Have him on my whoa, whoa, whoa. Andy, whoa, whoa, silver scream. Can't tell them apart at all.
KBOO Portland. Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM.
Hoy martes 24 de diciembre del 2024.
Unas noticias anteriores.